Richard Kaffer is here with us today to deliver the Wenschel Lecture on Effective Preaching. This is an annual event given through the endowment of the late Dr. Julius Wenschel. Reverend Kaffer is currently serving as the president of Iowa District West and has done so since 1985. His entire ministry prior to election was composed of campus ministry-related functions, serving in New Hampshire, in Michigan, and most recently on the campus of Iowa State University in Ames. And this is where I became acquainted with him during my first 2 years of undergraduate studies there. He was graduated from the University of Northern Iowa with a major in speech and drama, and later from Concordia Theological Seminary in Springfield. He has authored a book and numerous articles for church magazines and journals, and in 1977 was awarded the degree Doctor of Letters Honoris Causa from Concordia College in St. Paul, Minnesota. Speaking from my personal experience, President Kaffer was and still is held in high regard as a preacher and public speaker. And with great anticipation, I present to you the 1989 Wenschel Lecture and Reverend Richard Kaffer.
Well, I am greatly honored to have been asked to present the Wenschel Lecture to you. As some of you probably know, the Wenschel Lecture Series was established in 1949 by J. Frederick and Ann Wenschel for the purpose of furthering the education of seminary students in the practical aspects of preaching. At least that's what I was told. People who have been practitioners of the art of preaching, I assume, have been invited to share practical insights with present and future preachers through a convocation such as this. So it's kind of fun to be among you and to share some of these with you. We'll see. I'd like really to be able to just walk around here and talk off the cuff, but I really felt that with the formality of all these chomping mouths in front of me, I really ought to have a manuscript here and have my words down. So I will be using a manuscript with some apology, but nevertheless, I hope that some of it will also be rather extemporaneous. I suspect that in some ways, most preachers in the parish would really like to be able to have a chance to be up here. In fact, my suspicion is that those of you who have been through vicarage would like to have a chance to be up here because by this time, you know pretty well all there is to know about preaching because you are fourth-year men and you're wearing suits, I notice also, which is impressive. But I think all of us are really intrigued about the intricacies of preaching. Every preacher, it seems, has an opinion about how to prepare a sermon, how to get at the heart of a text, how to apply it to the hearer, and how to deliver it. For example, ask any preacher here his opinion about how many notes one should take into the pulpit, and I think you'll run the whole gamut of opinions basically based upon how many notes that person is comfortable with in the pulpit, or lack thereof. Some prefer no notes at all. It's sink or swim every Sunday morning. Others use 3x5-inch or 4x6-inch file cards, all neatly stacked in precise order, and they're set there on the pulpit table to be discarded as they use that method. Others, the ones I think who are the most intelligent, since that's the way I do it, take an 8.5x11 piece of paper, fold it in half, and take that up into the pulpit with them. And others prefer clutching the entire manuscript, a habit undoubtedly acquired after a disastrous experience in a homiletics class, even though they run the risk of distancing themselves from their hearers in their attempt not to forget even one precious word. In fact, if there's one gripe I have in the parish or as I sit in the pew, it is listening to sermons that are merely read from a manuscript, once in a while looking up. But I always have the feeling that I wouldn't have to be in that room. I could be listening to the radio. I could be in the next room. I could be in the narthex. I could be down in the nursery with the children. I really wouldn't have to be there because the preacher really doesn't care that I am there either when he begins to, I think, violate the use of a manuscript. But the same can be said about writing the sermon. Not long ago, and I'm not so sure you talk about these things, but it's been within my lifetime as a pastor, The homiletical task was simply disparaged as a thing of the past, and it should simply be cut out. We don't need that at all. Preaching took on a distinctly negative connotation. You know, don't preach to me. Others determined that the sermon was not at fault. It was the monological sermon that was at fault. And so dialogue sermons became very popular about 15 or 20 years ago. Much was made of the dialogue sermon, and not just during Lent, when poor old Pontius Pilate or Judas suddenly had to dialogue with, quotes, modern man, but also on Sunday when worship became an intimate setting for forced conversation, it seems to me. The reason we don't hear many rooting for dialogue sermons today is that the dialogue became nothing more than a glorified bull session. The people in the pew finally decided that it would be a good idea if the preacher got back to preaching and they got back simply to listening. The story sermon is probably the latest innovation. I think it has many things to commend it. My only difficulty with the story sermon is that the vagueness of so many of the stories and the lack of application to real lives, lives that don't merely want to have law and gospel suggested, but need both law and gospel in heaping and very direct forms, have limited its usefulness and its usage in the church. Others have reasoned, and very correctly, I think, that what is needed in Lutheran pulpits in particular is more creativity. Much has been written about that important component, and it is important. But the difficulty is that it's awfully difficult to pass on to someone else one's own creativity. Indeed, requiring someone to be creative is one certain way to inspire not creativity, but huge inhibitions and blandness. You get a sermon back and the professor says, be more creative in your next sermon. You'll spend all your time getting all uptight about how to be creative in the sermon, and it will come off as the most uncreative thing you've ever done. Well, still others have rightly observed that we preachers probably have our doctrine and our theology straight most of the time. But we tend to be terribly boring. What we need, we are told, is more interesting examples and illustrations. Don't tell me a truth, preacher, show me, is the plea. So off we run for another volume of illustrations and examples that are certain, we are assured, to speak truly to the lives of the hearers. And sometimes they do, but most of the time I suspect they are forced onto a text, leaving too many rough edges exposed. 3.5 years ago, I was elected to serve as a district president. After 22 years in the parish ministry, all of it within the campus ministry context, as you heard, all of it thoroughly committed Sunday after Sunday to preaching, I was suddenly placed into the position of preaching for occasions. Your seminary president has to do the same thing. Occasions like anniversaries, ordinations, installations, dedications, mission festivals, and spending many Sundays in the pew, where I hadn't been for a long, long time. And so it's really from the pew, as it were, that my remarks to you this morning have been formed. I'm addressing you mainly, I think, as rookie preachers, those of you who have only recently gotten started in the whole homiletical task, or some of you having spent a year of vicarage and feeling still, I think, like rookie preachers. And a number of you, of course, are old and true and tried veterans of the process. Regardless of where you are on the spectrum of experience and expertise, I'm going to assume that when you enter the pulpit on a Sunday morning, you know what you're talking about. And without being facetious, that is truly a big assumption. The scholarly side of sermon preparation is often tedious, demanding, time-consuming, and absolutely necessary. And the frustrating part is, on Monday morning, yesterday's sermon is like yesterday's newspaper, and you have to start thinking about next Sunday's sermon. The scholarly side, then, because it is that way, we simply can't, nevertheless, do away with the sermonic background work. It's directly, it should show within, it seems to me, the sermon, not all the edges. Most of that background, I suspect, has to stay in the study. But somehow it has to inform that whole sermon, or we're simply going to be schwaffling on a Sunday morning. Your hearers need to be assured each Sunday that you are being honest with them as a scholar. And that means honest scholarship in language study exegesis, commentary work, and writing skills. Your hearers have one more thing to ask of you. And their question, formed on my own lips from my place in the pew, is the title of this presentation. And this is the way I think they say it. Preacher, after you have completed all of the vital background work, so that I know that you know what you're talking about and you know that text completely, or as best as you can, after you have illustrated it, after you have intellectualized it, after you have applied it and exampled it and then begun to preach it, I have one more thing to ask of you. What does it feel like, preacher? What does it feel like? Are you feeling what I am feeling when I come into a church on a Sunday morning? Are you being honest with the text, with yourself, and with me? Do you live in my world? If you and I can answer that question in the affirmative, and I truly believe it is possible, and that it is crucial to our preaching that we do answer that question in the affirmative, then the illustrations, the examples, the applications, and creativity, I believe, will all fall into place and almost take care of themselves. With that question, which I know is a dangerous question, nevertheless, with that question, I would insist, but what does it feel like, preacher? We have taken on the task of taking you and me into who you are, down deep, inside. We are talking about even those of you who may be wonderfully adept as professor or as student in wrestling the meaning of the text through exegetical skills that are legendary, or those of you whose knowledge of history in, for example, the era of Isaiah, takes the reader or the listener into superb nuances of human life and thought that can make dusty manuscripts live, or those of you whose love for church dogma leads you to nod with understanding and approval when a text is unraveled and the polemical, the critical, and the apologetic task is made clear. But the master theologian, historian, dogmatician, exegete, and scholar are not detached from life. It was a great revelation for me as a child to discover my beloved second grade teacher in the grocery store buying food for a mortal body that needed to exist on more than chalk dust and Crayolas. It need be no revelation to suppose that the professor, the pastor, the student, the doctor, the lawyer, the bricklayer, the mechanic, the engineer, the displaced preacher on one Sunday are no more than sermonic critics. But next Sunday, chastened or merely reminded by God through human experience of who they are now listening not with mind so much as heart, a pounding heart, a broken heart, a sorrowing heart, a joyful heart. Most of my fellow pew sitters, especially those who are clergy pew sitters, and there are a number of you in this room, will tell you that too often preachers surely do abuse law and gospel. It's as though C.F.W. Walther hadn't written the proper distinction between law and gospel. Too often, though, we approach the mixing of law and gospel as an intellectual problem, and partly it is. Yet as Luther insisted, the theory of law and gospel is not really all that complicated. We have it in the catechism, and we talk about it. It is in the practice, Luther said, that we fail. And the failure is not a matter of the head most of the time. During the 1970s, I served on the homiletic subcommittee of the Commission on Church Literature. Among other assignments, we were responsible for securing the authors and reading the manuscripts for that beloved journal, the Concordia Pulpit. Far too frequently, we had to return the finished manuscript to the author, and most of those authors were parish pastors of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, with the notation, very gently written by Concordia Publishing House, that the sermon lacked clear gospel. Finally, after much complaining, and I suspect I was the one who complained the most, we decided that we needed to have a short booklet on law gospel preaching. I received that assignment, and the little treatise, Helpers of Joy, Applying the Gospel to Life, came into being. This booklet was given as a, what they called a bonus, with, I think, the 1974 Concordia Pulpit, and was sent to all the authors of the next Concordia Pulpit. It went into rather lengthy detail, rather inspired writing, actually, about the gospel, what it is and what it does. Eagerly, we all awaited the manuscripts from all those authors who had received that little booklet, Helpers of Joy. I felt that my reasoning was so clear, the writing was so intense, that nobody could argue with it, and we would suddenly have this transformation of the preachers within the LCMS. So in they came. And honestly, 90% of the manuscripts were almost totally and completely devoid of law. And all they had was gospel. Didn't the law preachers who excluded the gospel know what they were doing? Didn't they realize the terrible burden of unrelieved guilt they were heaping upon their readers or their listeners? And didn't the gospel preachers realize what they were doing? Gospel without law is happy talk. It's fluffy moralism, and just as guilt-inducing and harmful to faith as its opposite. In fact, sometimes I think it's more harmful, at least for Lutheran Christians, because we can hear heaps of law, and we can sort of talk back and say, yeah, that's true, but, or we can simply say, Lord, have mercy upon me, and somehow the gospel gets through in spite of the preacher. But when it's gospel, the gospel makes me feel terribly guilty if it's only gospel without having been preceded by the law. Because all of those wonderful things that the gospel does for me and all of the wonderful responses that should be mine because of the gospel all make me terribly guilty because I can't do any of them and I surely don't deserve what the gospel says to me. More to the point, what was missing in the preparation of these sermons that prevented these writers from the LCMS from perceiving what they were doing and not doing? I would submit that they had not heard the question from the pew, but what does it feel like, preacher? I'm not saying that's the answer for everything, but I am saying that that's one aspect of preaching that we simply don't ask enough. What does it feel like, preacher? In his 1838 Divinity School address at Harvard, Ralph Waldo Emerson expressed his disdain for a preacher whose sermon, quote, had not one word intimating that he had laughed or wept, was married or in love, had been commended or cheated or chagrined. The capital secret of his profession, namely to convert life into truth, he had not yet learned. The true preacher for Emerson was one who dealt out life to his listeners. Quote, life passed through the fire of his thought. Helmut Thielicke remarked about German pastors who had experienced the horrors of the Second World War as it devastated Germany. Many would have thought that this would have influenced their preaching, he wrote. Instead, he remarked about one preacher, in the pulpit he appeared to go on without any perceptible break from where he left off in 1939. Thielicke stated, if I see a breach, if I see no connection between his Christian and his human existence, so argues the average person consciously or unconsciously, then I am inclined to accept the conclusion that he himself is not living in the house of his own preaching, but has settled down somewhere beside it, and that therefore the center of gravity in his life lies elsewhere than in his preaching of the law and the gospel. We are then, and I want to make this clear, we are then not talking about emotionalism, sentimentality, navel-gazing, or feelings for the sake of feelings. We're talking about human persons sitting in the pews with very human feelings about life, people like you and like me. And we are talking about sacred scripture that talks much about human persons with human feelings about life and God and addresses those kinds of people. This morning at breakfast, I brought down with me some reading material I'd gotten just before I left Iowa. This was sent out, I think, by the Stewardship Commissioner of the Synod. And it's titled, this is from a speech by George Gallup, Jr., the 1990s, decade of the, quote, people's religion. And he based his remarks on a survey that they had done on the unchurched American, 1988. It was a follow-up to the same kind of survey in 1978, a decade earlier. And he says this, the 1990s will likely be the decade in which we will hear a more persistent voice from the laity who want a greater voice in the shaping of the church. The clergy appear increasingly willing to listen, but organized religion has not always listened carefully to what the laity are saying about their inner spiritual journeys. The just completed survey in which we compared the beliefs and lifestyles of the churched and unchurched shows that a growing complaint among both groups is that churches are not helping people deal with their religious doubts and spiritual needs. Then he goes on. Spiritual experiences of a power outside and directing oneself are widespread. Nearly half of Americans say that they have had such an experience. And a consistent one-third over the years have reported that they have had a religious experience, whatever that is, a moment of religious insight or awakening that changed the direction of their lives. This finding, that one-third of Americans have such breakthrough experiences, is, I believe, one of the most significant survey findings ever uncovered. That's the people that we have out there in the pew. Moreover, we are talking about the God who understands us as we are, including our human feelings, and about the Son of God who indeed can, as the NIV says it, sympathize with our weaknesses, or as the KJV says it, is touched with the feeling of our infirmities. The Lord understands us as whole persons. Part of who we are involves our emotions, our feelings. It is upon these that our discussion then focuses. In developing the theme for this presentation, a little book by Frederick Buechner kept coming to mind. Finally, I pulled it down off the shelf, skimmed its remarkable contents once more, and decided that I would borrow Buechner's three-part development and some of his insights. This book, titled Telling the Truth, the Gospel is Tragedy, Comedy, and Fairy Tale, gets right to the point. Writing of the preaching task, Buechner contends, we are all of us in it together, and it is in us all. So if preachers or lecturers are to say anything that really matters to anyone, including themselves, they must say it not just to the public part of us that considers interesting thoughts about the gospel and how to preach it, but to the private, inner part too, to the part of us all where our dreams come from, both our good dreams and our bad dreams, the inner part where thoughts mean less than images, elucidation less than evocation, where our concern is less with how the gospel is to be preached than with what the gospel is and what it is to us. They must address themselves to the fullness of who we are and to the emptiness, too. The emptiness where grace and peace belong, but mostly are not, because terrible as well as wonderful things have happened to us all. This is not to say that the hearer must set the agenda any more than it is right to say that the world must set the agenda for the church. But it is to say that the Lord did not become flesh in order merely to read to humanity or to preach to it or to lecture it. That could have been done by specially called prophets as in the past. The Lord became flesh in order to dwell among us in all of our humanity. He came to our world in order to be for us the key to the kingdom. He made sure that people knew the kingdom was in their midst. People like the woman at Jacob's well, the man born blind, the Gentile whose daughter had died, and on and on. There is a world out there that shares something with the preacher. Listen to Buechner. The preacher must always try to feel what it is like to live inside the skins of the people he is preaching to hear the truth as they hear it. That is not as hard as it sounds, because, of course, he is himself a hearer of truth as well as a teller of truth, and he listens out of the same emptiness as they do for a truth to fill him and make him true. I've often wondered as a district president how a pastor, I think of one in particular, who had been carrying on some incestuous things with a couple of his children, and he had to be confronted because his wife finally told me. And I'll never forget, at noon, one of the daughters came home, and I met her in the kitchen after I had talked to her father, and I said to her, your father's not going to be living here anymore, and what's been happening to you isn't going to happen again. And her eyes just welled up with tears, and she kept saying, thank you, thank you. Now, how odd for a daughter to say thank you for getting my father out of the house. But the question was, what happened to that preacher Sunday after Sunday for 10 or 12 years that he could do this to his daughters and yet get in the pulpit? And I suspect one of the reasons besides our terrible old Adam, one of the reasons is that he simply intellectualized the faith and never asked that question from the emptiness and from the sorrow and from the fallenness that binds up all of us by nature. In other words, our linkage between the Word and the hearer under the Spirit is not so much found by simply examining the lives of our hearers, as helpful as this might be, you know, getting into their homes, finding out who they are, but I think even more important, it is found by looking within at the person that I am, that person who is so desperately empty without the indwelling Christ and whose spirit longs for his word. It is not so much that we and our hearers come into church on a Sunday morning burdened with a particular sin, although that is often the case, surely. Perhaps more frequently, we come to church with a total lack of awareness of the tragedy of our blindness. In fact, part of that confession this morning sort of spoke of that. We really can't imagine a world where God really and truly lives. For our world leaves little room for God. If we were to envision a city of God, I can't imagine what it would look like. I'm too sinful to even imagine it, or even to imagine what heaven is except a lack of some things, but what other things would it have? And I can't imagine it. Thus it was that a servant of Elisha rose one morning, you remember the story, and much to his consternation he looked up and saw an army of the king of Syria with horses and chariots surrounding the city and preparing to take him and his master Elisha captive. The servant was undoubtedly ready to write a quick sermon on when bad things happen to good people. But before he took pen to scroll, he decided that he ought to tell Elisha what he had seen. Elisha then showed him what really could be seen. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. The servant saw this only when the Lord answered Elisha's prayer and opened his eyes. The 40th chapter of Isaiah opens with these wonderful words of peace and renewal. Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that her warfare is ended. This is followed by an announcement of future hope. In the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, you know, the Advent text. These are great words of comfort and encouragement for the people of Israel, filled with the imagery of the coming God himself. Yet these are followed immediately by other words. A voice says, cry. And I said, what shall I cry? All flesh is grass, and all its beauty is like the flower of the field. And then just to make sure that the audience, an audience that at least includes God and may even be exclusively God, gets the point, he then expands on the lament, the grass withers, the flower fades, when the breath of the Lord blows upon it, surely the people is grass. Isaiah is exhibiting, it seems, a bit of rebelliousness, certainly not a church growth attitude coming to the surface in this prophet of God. And why? Because even if Israel gets comforted, and even if Israel sees the glory of the Lord revealed, it won't last long. Never has, never will. That's how Israel is, always has been. And the parish pastor may feel like an Isaiah uttering the same lament. He serves a congregation of chronic backsliders. His delinquency file is almost larger than his communicant member file. When he graduated from the seminary, he was determined to turn his congregation on the prairie into a minor seminary. He was convinced that his members would respond to Bible studies, advanced courses in hermeneutics and church doctrine workshops, if only given the chance and the motivation from an inspiring teacher, namely himself. Then he discovered that they didn't want Bible study, courses in doctrine, or biblical interpretation, especially not on their bowling night. He wasn't even sure they wanted him. Moreover, they always seemed poised to criticize him and often did. Now in the dark days of February, Lent has begun, and his weeks are even busier. The confirmation class is ever more restless. On top of that, a voice says, cry. And he responds, what shall I cry? What's there to shout about? Writes Buechner, as much as it is our hope, it is our hopelessness that brings us to church of a Sunday, and any preacher who, whatever else he speaks, does not speak to that hopelessness might as well save his breath. Out there in the pew is the single parent whose week has been spent hurrying her child to the daycare center before work, trying hard to keep ahead of her boss and the demands of her job, picking up her child, shopping for groceries, making a meal, reading stories while helping the older child with his homework, tucking the children into bed, and then, in the short time she has to herself, running through a load of laundry. She is in church, and she is awaiting a word from the Lord, but she too is having a hard time with a voice that says, "Cry." "What shall I cry, Pastor? When I finally have time for a date, if anyone will even consider dating me, I have to put up with..." She stops in mid-sentence. Then, "The men out there, they're animals, Pastor. You don't know." The grass withers, the flower fades. Surely the people is grass. The law then is certainly accusatory, but it's more than accusatory. And to look only for the law's accusation in a text is to miss, I think, an even deeper dimension sometimes in some texts of the law and of human need. Within the heart of every hearer is the universal awareness that something is awfully wrong with this life in this world. Buechner calls this the gospel as tragedy. And he's not here trying to confuse law and gospel when saying this. Rather, he is insisting, and we would affirm him, that, quote, "beneath our clothes, our reputations, our pretensions, beneath our religion or our lack of it, we are all vulnerable to the storm without and to the storm within. And if ever we are to find true shelter, it is with the recognition of our tragic nakedness and need for true shelter that we have to start." Dr. O.P. Kretzmann said it another way: "The hour of the husks has come, and it seems to be the task now to make that perfectly clear by sharp, relentless, and persistent criticism of the way of the world. The prodigal will return only when the application of the divine law has brought him to the realization that he and the swine are eating the same food." Writes Buechner, "Thus it seems to me that this is also where anyone who preaches the gospel has to start too. After the silence that is truth comes the news that is bad before it is good, the word that is tragedy before it is comedy, because it strips us bare in order ultimately to clothe us. We are each of us vulnerable human beings. By nature, we know that, although many spend their lives trying to deny this, living as though there is no accountability, no death, and no God. Nevertheless, there is the anguish of heart that must face the fact that we live in a fallen world where things are not what they could and what they should be. That tragedy lies just around the next corner. And even the good days seem a mere prelude to the awful days. We are truly vulnerable, and that too is the tragedy. Our people live in it, and we do also. And the word addresses that and us. So must we, the preachers." In fact, someone has said, "If you don't believe in original sin, have a child." And I think also, if you want to believe in original sin, just start getting older. When things begin to fall apart, and the conversation I've noticed at supper when I'm out with preachers or anybody else who are my age is, "What's your cholesterol count?" And everybody's trying to eat meals which are, I'm growing gills since I've eaten so much fish to get over a high cholesterol. We're all, I guess, in that same boat. Having said all this, there is the temptation to treat law, and therefore gospel, in a superficial manner. The preacher's problem, among others, states Buechner, is to deal with those problems only to which there is, however complex and hard to arrive at, a solution. For example, one of the reasons I suspect that the church in its wisdom has decided that homiletics ought to be a required course in the seminarian's training is because too often we suppose that having mastered to some degree the exegetical and doctrinal requirements of preaching, we have mastered all that preaching requires. The rest is practical, as opposed to theological, we sniff with some disdain and contempt. Yet the scholar, as necessary as he definitely is in the parish, is not yet a pastor. And the best pastor is one who is scholar, theologian, pastor. Homiletics is exceedingly theological, and scholarship in the hands of the pastor is exceedingly practical. The pastor then is required to do more than master the text. He is required also to come to terms with the tough issues involved in living in a tragically fallen world. Buechner writes, "For the preacher to be relevant to the staggering problems of history is to risk being irrelevant to the staggering problems of the ones who sit there listening out of their own histories. To deal with the problems to which there is a possible solution can be a way of avoiding the problems to which, humanly speaking, there is no solution." I taught a speech at Eastern Michigan University. I was as low as you can get on the academic totem pole. I was a temporary part-time lecturer. You can't get any lower than that. But the speeches that were given, especially those that were to persuade, always ended up being these speeches that at the end you had to write your congressman. That was always the final line. That was ad nauseum, always write your congressman. That's the way those rather simple questions that we think are so terribly difficult questions in the world out there, that's how they were to be answered. But the really tough questions are the ones that you and I deal with as parish pastors. Those are the ones, humanly speaking, that have absolutely no solution. Romans chapter 8, verses 35 to 39. A famous portion of Scripture that includes the words, "Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution," it goes on from there, "no, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us," are words of abundant power and hope, but they are mere happy talk assertions in which some of our fundamentalist friends like to engage if they are spoken without the cry, "What shall I cry?" of the words that precede. Verses 31 to 34 must first be spoken. That's the tragic world of fallenness and helplessness where real people and not theoretical people live. To graduate from college, I had to take a course in swimming. I didn't know how to swim to graduate from the university. And I remember this one poor guy he was worse than I was in water. And he clung to the side of the pole and he kept pleading to the instructor, "But I'm a natural sinker." He kept saying it over and over, "I'm a natural sinker." Well, that's what, it seems to me, verses 31 to 34 are really addressing. "Who shall bring any charge against God's elect?" asks Paul. "Who is to condemn?" asks the apostle. Now, if you're sitting in the pew and you hear those words, and if you know that God is very smart and that he's all-knowing, then God should bring charges and God should condemn again and again and do it against me. Why did Paul ask those questions? Who shall bring any charge against God's elect? Who is to condemn? Because under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, he must have asked those questions, and so he knew had his readers. So he admitted it, took it on, and with it told the truth of admitting the tragedy of being natural sinkers, leads one into the question asked once again, "But what does it feel like, preacher?" And that leads into comedy, asserts Buechner. Comedy understood, of course, in a very special way. Now the preacher is ready to respond to the question of human tragedy, "What shall I cry?" He points to fallenness, but points beyond. The grass withers, the flower fades, and then that wonderful little word, "But." But there is far more to the story than tragedy. But when it comes, it comes as incredible surprise. It comes, writes Buechner, in the sound of laughter, of an old woman and an old man knocking themselves out in a tent. It starts out dry and small and ends up so uproarious and big that to question is, that to preserve his dignity, even the angel has to turn his face aside. Before we ask any questions about it, says Buechner, we should just listen to it. It starts with a startled catch of the breath because the last thing either of them expected to do was to laugh, and it takes them by surprise as much as it takes us. It wells up in their throats like sorrow, only it is not sorrow, and contorts their old faces like tears, only that's not what it is either, or at least a different kind of tears. Their shoulders shake, their faces go red, their china teeth slip a notch. She will be 91 on her next birthday. And the angel says she will celebrate it in the maternity ward. Sarah stuffs her apron to her mouth. Abraham gasps for air. Then the question, suggests Buechner, where does this laughter come from? It comes from as deep a place as tears come from, and in a way it comes from the same place. As much as tears do, it comes out of the darkness of the world where God is of all missing persons the most missed, except that it comes not as an ally of darkness, but as its adversary, not as a symptom of darkness, but as its antidote. The people in the pew believe the law. Well, sometimes they have to be reminded of it. Sometimes it must accuse them and their self-righteousness. Most of the time, it must tell them of the tragedy of fallenness, the great tragedy of being aware of tragedy, is that we lose our capacity, even as Christians, to believe the comedy. Mary and Martha, overcome by the tragedy of fallenness that took their brother away, were unprepared for the gospel. Someday, in the resurrection, whatever that is, Lord, then we'll see Lazarus again. Perhaps also for the tragedy of what fallenness does to even the most trusting, Jesus wept. Buechner writes, people are prepared for everything except for the fact that beyond the darkness of their blindness, there is a great light. They are prepared to go on breaking their backs, plowing the same old field until the cows come home without seeing, until they stub their toes on it, that there is a treasure buried in that field rich enough to buy Texas. We have families out there in the pew who have tremendous problems, living with fallenness in their homes and tremendous tragedies, but who cannot believe that there is the true forgiveness of sins and the power through the gospel to change everything, to start all over again. And they have a hard time believing it. Sometimes the preacher also can't quite believe it that. Anticipating this, C.F.W. Walther wrote, make a vow to God that you will adopt the apostles' method, that you will not stand in your pulpit sad face as if you were bidding men to come to a funeral, but like men who go wooing a bride or announcing a wedding. Indeed, the gospel is unbelievable, for who could possibly contrive it or suppose it? What happened to Abraham and Sarah, insists Buechner, happened not of necessity, not inevitably, but gratuitously, freely, hilariously. And what was astonishing, gratuitous, hilarious, was, of course, the grace of God. What could they do but laugh at the preposterousness of it? And they laughed until the tears ran down their cheeks. A number of years ago, I saw a church bulletin cover that seemed to understand the comedy, the intense surprise of the gospel. In a pen and ink drawing was depicted a street scene that could easily have been drawn just down the street from this church in Brooklyn. Superimposed over the scene was the surprising title, Jesus Receives Sinners, Hallelujah. In that simple scene and simple wording was a summary of the 15th chapter of the Gospel according to St. Luke. That chapter begins, as you may recall, with the words, now the tax collectors and sinners were drawing near to hear him. And the Pharisees and the scribes murmured, saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them. On the outside were the Pharisees and scribes hissing, this man receives sinners and eats with them for shame. On the inside, where Jesus was, the people who gathered around the table of fellowship and food were singing, this man receives sinners and eats with them, hallelujah. That even includes somebody like me. It is in the surprise of contrast that the surprise of grace breaks through. And it is in the lack of surprise that grace is missed, at least for the preacher. It is also missed by the person in the pew. We are conditioned to believe and accept the law. We may fight it, we may deny it, we may disbelieve it on one level, but on a deeper level we believe it because it is true. But people, and sometimes our most receptive and faithful people in the pew, don't always believe the gospel. We live with tragedy and tragedy's consequences every day. It's carried into our homes with the newspaper or the 6 o'clock news. It's evident in the workplace, even the church office or the elders' meetings. And it's also evident in the home. The tragic, declares Buechner, is the inevitable. On the other hand, there is another unseen, surprising, uproarious dimension to life, which is that the comic is the unforeseeable. It takes us by surprise. Jesus followed those sneers of the scribes and Pharisees with the parables of surprise. The lost sheep for whom the shepherd leaves the 99 in order to find, and finding places him over his shoulder, shouting to everybody you can hear, including the angels, "Rejoice with me, look who I found," and he's saying, "Your name and my name." He told of a woman losing a coin and then finding it and inviting in the neighbors to celebrate. The angels, Jesus insists, also join in the partying. He told of a son who betrayed father and home and country in order to serve himself, fell far from help, but was restored by the prodigal grace of his father. And he told of a second son who hissed in his own way, "This man receives sinners and kills the fatted calf for them for shame." Perhaps it is that children hear and believe the gospel so openly and readily because the inevitability of tragedy is not yet apparent and the surprise of grace is not so unlikely. It is as the lost sheep, the lost coin, the reunited son, that we can listen for the sound of laughter, the sound from the Father's lips, even at the expense of his only begotten Son. But what does it feel like, preacher, to be lost like that? "Have you ever been there?" asked the person in the pew. "Do you know what it means to confess, 'I, a poor, miserable sinner?'" "It feels like this," says the preacher, reading the text, not for its emotionalism, but for its connection between the Father waiting on the front porch and the Son in the far country. "It feels like this because I have been there in the Word, and I have been there with the people in the pew. Further, the Father has placed me on his front porch of the pulpit to tell about the Father's open heart of love." To take seriously the question, "But what does it feel like, preacher?" does not distort the text. It presses one to understand the text even more deeply. Adam's response to God's literally giving away of the bride in Eden is preceded by the mysterious words of melancholy, "But for the man there was not found a helper fit for him." When the Lord brought the woman to the man, his response was not a cerebral, "Finally, someone who has a tibia like mine," but a celebrational response from a man just past adolescence saying, "This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh." Adam responded from the freshness of Eden and of life itself. The people in the pew might very well respond, "Where did my youth, my wonder, my joy, and my enthusiasm go? What happened to my zeal, my love, my commitment?" That's the tragedy. It's the tragedy of the man now old saying, "From my nose on up, I'm still 20 years old. And I really do think of myself as being 20 years old," he said. "But from there on down, I'm an old man." It's the seminary or the university professor, soon to retire, wishing that he could start at age 30, where he is now in his scholarly and professional world, and knowing that he can't. The list could go on and on. And they are all there on a Sunday morning as you clear your throat. They're waiting for a word from you, hoping to see the open door of the Father's house, longing to begin as new as a Nicodemus wanting to be born again. "But," cried Isaiah, "but in spite of all this, in spite of our intellectual objections, despite our fallenness in a fallen world, our sharing in the withering grass and fading flower existence, but the word of our God will stand forever." What does that mean to the Nicodemus in the pew who wants renewal and needs renewal? What does it mean when Luther spoke of our daily renewal in holy baptism? Why did the voice from heaven say of Jesus as he stepped from the baptismal waters, "This is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased"? The Father said it for the benefit of the disciples, one can be quite sure, and for the benefit of those who read and read Matthew's account, of course. But far more important, the words of the Father were spoken about and to the Son for the benefit of the Son. Fathers do that. Jesus needed to hear these words of inaugurations there at the Jordan River. Centuries before, Jehovah had spoken through his prophet the words, "Behold my servant." Now again, the Father puts his own stamp of approval upon the obedient messianic servant Jesus Christ. "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Hear he is, world, ready or not, look at him. He is my beloved one." In holy baptism, by which we are baptized into the death and resurrection of this same Jesus, we are God's servants in the name and for the sake of God's Son. With the freshness of daily renewal, we come forth out of the baptismal water with the Father's declaration over us, "This is my beloved daughter. This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased." Our response may be one of incredulity, spoken from the perspective of tragedy, saying, "I can't be like that. That doesn't describe me." But our Father insists, because that's the way our Father is. "You are my child. I not only love you, I like you. Not because of what you are by nature, but because of what you have become through faith in my Son. I see you through him. I see you dripping with the water of your baptism." It's like an earthly father inviting a visitor to his home to take a moment to come down the hallway. And he opens the doorway just a little bit, and the light from the hallway goes across the bed of his little child who's sleeping in the bed. And he says to this visitor, "Look at her. Isn't she beautiful? Isn't she wonderful just sleeping like that in that bed?" Unimpressed, the visitor responds, "Yeah, I guess so. But what's so special about seeing a child who's simply sleeping?" "What's so special," responds the father, "is that she is my child. She is beautiful even when she is doing absolutely nothing, because she is mine." How much more doesn't our Heavenly Father insist on saying that of us through the renewing words of the gospel? Buechner calls this view of life as viewed through faith and holy baptism as fairy tale. He is not describing the Christian life of sanctification as a pipe dream, a pretend story, much wishful thinking. Instead, he is talking about the new life that cannot always be pinned down to earthly categories. Try as one might, the Beatitudes won't allow themselves to be squeezed into do's and don'ts of the local community church. When denominations try hard to describe in detail what a Christian husband, wife, child, parent, pastor, business person, or tradesperson should look like, I think they go too far. The juice is squeezed out of the gospel incentive, and Christian freedom is too often the victim. I remember reading a little devotion from a pastor, a campus pastor, in fact. He wrote about a woman in his campus parish who he said had gone through all kinds of things. She had seen the best and the finest of life, and she'd also seen the roughest and the sharpest edges of life. And yet she always had this equanimity about her, this stability about her in all things. And finally he asked her, "What's your secret? Why are you that way? And her response was, "It was the China." She said, "My parents were in China when the Japanese came, and we had to stay there. And we lived in complete degradation during the Second World War. But," she said, "my father always insisted on it, no matter how meager our meal, we always ate on the fine china." That's the story, it seems to me, of the Christian life. That's what Paul is saying when he says, whatsoever things are just and pure and all those beautiful words, think on these things. That's what he's talking about. Fairy tale means, it seems to me, reading next Sunday's Old Testament reading for the second Sunday in Lent from Jeremiah chapter 26 and seeing that the tragedy inherent in Jeremiah's predicament and situation is that his opponents don't want to see life in the kingdom the way God wants them to see it, in all of its fullness and joy and freedom, so they turn their backs on it. And he's saying, don't. Therein lies both the fairy tale and the tragedy. In the gospel for next Sunday, Jesus calls out to, in those pathetic words, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem." And he calls out from the perspective of the life and salvation that Jerusalem is rejecting. In imagery that approaches that of fairy tale, Jesus laments the tragedy of not seeing what could have been. "How often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you would not. It is the fairy tale of the new life that sharpens the tragedy. The epistle for next Sunday from Philippians could easily be composed by parents who tell a tale of the fairy tale of childhood that has disappeared for their child, who now lives as an enemy of the cross of Christ. But the fairy tale is not far off. It is as close as repentance and the renewing of the Holy Spirit. It is as close as next Sunday's proclamation. So finally, in conclusion, next Sunday, the pews will be filled where you preach, if you're preaching this Sunday. They will look up to you for a word from God. And once again, I believe they will be asking, but what does it feel like, preacher? We would suggest that you answer the question in the following ways. Number one, ask the human feeling life situation question of the text. What was going on then? What is the human emotion, human problem, human need, human tragedy that is stated or implied? Put yourself into that age. You know, you can't do any of these things unless you've done the background work, unless you've done the exegetical work, unless you've done the commentary work, unless you've done the historical research. But put yourself now, after having done all that, into that age. Put yourself there, into that situation of the text. Put your curiosity to work. How would it affect you? How are you similar to those people in the text? What questions, hurts, needs, and emotions are triggered in you? Number three, look less for examples outside the text and more from within. Those that speak to the human need and the question, but what does it feel like, preacher? In the answer are far more numerous and far more relevant examples and illustrations of the textual truth than anywhere else, it seems to me. Also, they will help you to think theologically about life and not just about your sermon, which is the best way to develop life-related sermons. Number four, explore the implications of tragedy, implied or stated in the text, as you develop law applications. Number five, explore the gospel signals in the text. Listen for the laughter, not on the surface, but bubbling up from underneath, ready to surprise. Look for the surprise, the news that is so good it takes one's breath away, and so powerful that it takes one's sins and shame away. Number six, look for the fairy tale, the vision of the new life, the new way of looking at life, of living it, and of sharing it. Look, as St. Paul says, with the eyes of your hearts enlightened. But what does it feel like, preacher? It feels like this, Buechner would reply, and so would I. Let the preacher preach this overwhelming of tragedy by comedy, of darkness by light, of the ordinary by the extraordinary, as the tale that is too good not to be true, because to dismiss it as untrue is to dismiss along with it that catch of the breath, that beat and lifting of the heart, near to or even accompanied by tears, which I believe is the deepest intuition of truth that we have. Thank you for your attention. I think we have some time for some questions or comments or another donut. Yes. That in the Christian church at large, that preaching is probably around somewhere around a 6. But I don't think it's that high in the Missouri Synod. Anybody want me to expand on that? Somehow we've lost something in our pulpits. I hear so many sermons that really are so dull. They are so predictable. The preacher is so unexcited. It's as though the text bored him to death on Monday when he started it, and it went downhill from there. And that's unfair, and I know that's unfair, but that's how it sounds, and that's how I have to listen. I get to the point sometimes where I almost despair of growing in my Christian faith through the sermon on Sunday, and so I've concentrated a lot more on my personal devotional life as a district president and also with my wife and our family devotions. And I mentioned that to her the other night, going home from a Lenten service I had attended, and unfortunately it was from God's caring people, part of the His Love, Our Response emphasis. And that stewardship process provides full-blown sermons. But it was obviously that the pastor had not done anything more than to take the full-blown sermon into the pulpit with him and read the bloomin' thing. And I just couldn't take it, you know. I said to Lois, I hope I'm still a Christian when I'm done being a district president. I think I had better be done sooner than later. People say that about district presidents anyway. Can a district president be saved? I think that's probably a good question to ask. I didn't know there was a question.
Is it true that you agree that preaching is one of the main factors that affect the number of membership?
Absolutely. That's where the people of God gather together. That's where hearts are mended, where people are corrected. It's where the community of faith gathers together. I just read an interesting article on, I'm not sure I agree with the whole thing, but it has to do with service centers and the whole matter of Christian servanthood, which I've done a lot of thinking and studying, mainly because I've had to get papers on it, but in terms of Christian servanthood in the New Testament. And this article makes the point, and he does it from a Christian perspective, that we have to be careful with servanthood, because when people have tried to be servants, that is, have service centers in the ghetto areas and housing complexes and so forth, people simply lie back and depend upon the service, and it becomes almost worthless in the lives of people. But he said if you establish community, then out of the community, people begin to reach out to one another. Then all kinds of good things happen. It seems to me that is a description of the Christian church. It is in community that wonderful things happen within the setting of the congregation. And the focal point of that, the focus of that community is on the hearing of the word and the reception of the sacraments. That's where it really is placed. That to me has been the strength and the power of campus ministry in the Missouri Synod, and the other denominations tell me the same thing. I've had laymen. I remember sitting across the table from a man at a service organization meeting in Fort Dodge, where our district office is, and he said to me, I attend a Memorial Lutheran Church where you were pastor. He said, I'm a Presbyterian. I said, that's nice. Didn't you go to the Presbyterian church with your son? And he said, no, he always came to your church. And he said, I know why. He said, you people really do concentrate upon word and sacrament there, and the other church didn't do that. I'm not knocking the Presbyterians. I'm just simply saying that's been our power. That's been our strength. Therefore, the more we can put into the preparation of sermons for Sunday morning, the better off we are. And it takes time. There's no doubt about it. We have to put a high priority upon that. But it seems to me it's in the sermon where not only the people of God gather, but where all of our theology gathers too. That's where it all finally comes together in the expression to the people of God, that in our teaching role.
Here, first.
You kept talking about what does it feel like, preacher? I think it seems like part of what you're saying, maybe this is very much what you're saying, is that the preacher examines the text and everything to do with it, but he sees how it affects him and really gets down to his own spiritual life, and he tells the people that, not just him, but the effectiveness of the gospel and law and gospel in the text where it happens, and also how it happened with him. And he tells it, and you say, what does it feel like, preacher? You're saying, preacher, what does it feel like to you? What do you mean? Don't come through the illustration, well, it feels like this here and like this there. But what does it feel to you? What does it mean now? And that's drawn out from the text and the whole situation of the text.
You heard me right.
It seems to me that it's wonderful to get to know our people, but not so much for sermon illustrations. It's good to know our people so that when I go into that text and ask that question, what does it feel like, preacher, and first apply it to myself and ask those kinds of questions, I can then, if I know my people, I can say how the way I feel and the things that are kind of welling up from inside of my own soul, my own whole being, I can universalize that now because I know my people too. They're feeling the same things. They're facing the same dilemmas. I know that because I've been among them. Not for sermon illustrations, but to be able to universalize, to understand it's not just me, but they're feeling this also.
So there is the spiritual exercise of sermon preparation, not just the academic.
Just listen to Paul has said, take heed to yourself, and number two, and to all the flock. But first to yourself. Here first.
Sorry, it's kind of ironic. Earlier you had mentioned how when you asked pastors about their self-opinion, that many of them think they're really great preachers, and yet on the other hand, your evaluation is our preaching is below average. And so I guess my question is, I've always wondered, how is it that our preachers develop such a high opinion of themselves? What is meaning this illusion? And it strikes me that continuing education is never really going to take off the ground until we all feel that we need to improve.
I think our preachers don't think there's a problem. I think we've done such a good job of saying, and please understand me rightly, but I think we've done such a good job of saying to preachers and to all of us, just preach the word. You know, that the Holy Spirit's work is to take it from there. But the Holy Spirit uses instruments, and I think we should be the sharpest instrument we can be. That's why you're here. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a seminary. But I think we've simply used that almost as a way to excuse a lot of sloppy work or no work at all. It's hard work being a parish pastor. One of the hardest things to do is to have a sermon Sunday after Sunday. All of us, each one of us has one really good sermon. I think all of our lay people have one good sermon. It's probably all law, but one good sermon that they could preach. But after that, what are you going to say? You probably all have one good book, but what about the second book? And what about 52 Sundays a year, and then when Lent and Advent come, and you have several funerals thrown in also? It takes a lot of work, and a lot of our preachers do not put priority there at all. I think that's a sad mistake. Secondly, I think that most of us really are threatened by anything like a videotaping so that we could see what we do. So what do? We ask our wives. And our wives, shouldn't really be there as critics. That's the last thing they should do. They need to be fed. They need to be fed by simply being a child and listening and not having to afterwards say, your introduction was fairly good, except you could have on the second point of your introduction maybe said it this way. Now, that's not what they're about. But we always do that. I do the same thing. We're going home and I say, my wife wouldn't say anything. I say, what'd you think? About what? What about the sermon? Well, I don't know. And that's about all I get. Finally, I just wouldn't ask her anymore. Yeah.
You speak, I think, of an ideal that we should all strive to achieve. Time for sermon preparation. Reality cries against that. Facing that effect, how might you suggest we attempt to educate our congregation, our elders, in that it has to be a priority for us? They understand us as basically, I think today, people that need to do everything that they want us to do. And we come in, I think rightly so, with different priorities. We must concentrate on that preparation. That's the most important. might you suggest that we tell these people so that they can understand what that means to us and what it ultimately means to them?
Well, first of all, I think your people will forgive a lot of stuff if you show
in the pulpit through preparation and through a caring style that you really love them in the pulpit and that you love them on the street also. They'll forgive a lot of other stuff in between. Number two, I had a friend who graduated from the seminary same time I did, and he had a mission congregation, and mine was too, in New Hampshire, his town gown ministry. And this guy, he would dink around with everything under the sun, and finally on Saturday morning he would be just hurrying to get a sermon done, but he was far less busy, I think, than I was. But I simply made it a priority on Monday morning that I got on that sermon, and I got to the office at 8 o'clock, established that, and after devotions, the first thing I did, because the telephone doesn't ring very often early in the morning, I began to work on that. And so every morning was set aside at least 3 hours, I suppose, for maybe Monday through Thursday of getting that sermon ready. And if I didn't have the sermon pretty well in hand by Thursday noon, I'll tell you, I was panicking. I was really panicking. And then I would spend Saturday morning putting it into my head. But it takes that kind of time. I don't think it should be, 2 hours for every minute or 1 hour for every minute. I'm not so sure that's the right, some guys would then have 5 minute sermons, 5 minutes a week. But I think rather it has to be that we really put a priority on preaching because we should. We are ministers of the word, and that's where it's got to be. The afternoon I would spend on the things where I didn't have to think because I don't think well in the afternoon, I get a little groggy. So that was hospital call time and counseling time if need be and this and that sort of thing. And fall asleep while I was, I didn't fall asleep while I was.
Yes.
I have touched a subject which I have felt in my head in my mind quite a while. That is along us, the terms like feeling, what you feel, what I feel. Now these are some of foreign languages, I do not hear too often.
I know.
Because historically and as well as theologically, Lutherans are afraid of using those terms because we have history of Martin Luther burned his finger, by Samurai and others and the like. Now, my question is, I agree with you within the context of your speech. That is, we have some more excitement. What does I feel? What do I feel? It's more my existential, my personal reaction to what God has done for me and the like. Now, at the same time, you have warned, which I also agree, that we should not fall into the pitfall of subjectivism and emotionalism. Now my question is, what is your advice? Is this feeling, human feeling, and one feels excitement, emotionalism, all these things are same category stuff, except the degree of difference.
Sure.
But instead these things can be wrong, and that is subjectivism and emotionalism, just like intellectual. Being intellectual can be good, but intellectualism is another thing. Now, how would you really give some practical advice for us who is less capable in using quote feeling, as you suggested, but still keep the Lutheran tradition of the objective validity of this truth claim?
Good question.
Number one, I would never preach a sermon in the first person. Or this happened to my child said this to me. I think all those personal references most of the time have no place in a sermon. Number two, I believe that I would try always to stand back from how do I feel about this? What impact does it make upon me? I would always try to universalize it. So it is, if it only fits me, then I don't think I would use it. I would always try to universalize this. Does this also fit my understanding of human beings and people in my parish? I think that helps with the application, helps dampen that excess emotionalism. Thirdly, I guess because I had a drama background, I was always careful not to become an actor in the pulpit or to overuse the dramatic just for the sake of drama. I probably went the other way. So I guess I would have that feeling of standing back from the text and asking the question, could this be preached almost anywhere? Does it have that universal quality? In other words, am I avoiding schmaltz? And that what you call excess emotionalism. So it's really a matter of degree. It's hard to give a formula, but I think it has to do with standing back from the text and from what I'm going to prepare in the sermon and asking, am I still able to have some objectivity about this? I want to avoid, that's the word, subjectivity I want to avoid. There ought to be objectivity even in one's feelings. And that's what I mean when I talk about the universality of the text and of what is drawn out of the text. Are we done with time?
Yeah. Thank you for all your questions, and I'm sure
President Caffer would be willing to speak with you in person afterwards. So if we could give him one more round of applause. Thank you for coming.